lots of people have an interest in this particular article, the use of angiotensin tube.
Is this a drug that is a game changer in terms of shortening length of stay?
Are we really only talking about sepsis, or are there other things?
Mortality is over 50%. I affectionately refer to the trial as the Ellis Island trial.
What's the big drum roll here, results? Welcome back here to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And this podcast, I am joined by two very, very special guests to talk about a very hot topic in the literature, just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a study discussing a research article on the use of angiotensin II in vasodilatory shock. And these two guests are incredibly special because they participated in the lead authorship of this article. Sitting immediately to my right is Dr. Michael McCurdy. You've heard Mike before on the podcast talking about some important emergency medicine and critical care topics. And with him is one of his research coordinators, Osman Ali, who's also got some nice insight into the actual administration of this particular medication. So gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Mike.
Thank you.
So Mike, let me turn to you first. This is a very hot topic. It's gotten a lot of discussion already on social media, blog sites. Lots of people have an interest in this particular article, the use of angiotensin II. But let's back up just a second here and kind of give your impression or your thoughts on when we talk about vasodilatory shock, are we really only talking about sepsis or are there other things?
Well, Mike, the most common cause of vasodilatory shock is sepsis. It's really the foremost issue at hand when discussing it. So for all intents and purposes, I think that can focus the discussion. And that's what exactly this research focuses on.
All right. So in terms of angiotensin II, what is it and why did people start thinking it may be useful in vasodilatory shock? What's the background here?
So the background's pretty fascinating, actually. Currently in our armamentarium for the management of septic shock and to maintain an adequate mean arterial pressure, which really is globally an important parameter to control when optimally managing these patients. We only have certain catecholamines, namely norepinephrine is one of our first-line agents. We have vasopressin, you know, going down the hilargine vasopressin pathway, and we're kind of left at that and choosing which catecholamine, if norepinephrine and vasopressin fail, to go to. The options really are not ideal. For those patients with septic shock that have refractory hypotension despite adequate fluids and vasopressor support, mortality is over 50%. And about a quarter or so of patients with septic shock have this problem. So it's a very important issue that we have yet to fully understand and properly address globally. So a little bit of background, and I alluded to a couple of pathways that our bodies, from a homeostasis standpoint, utilize to maintain blood pressures. As I mentioned, the catecholamine pathway. We have the vasopressin pathway from the posterior pituitary, and we have this RAS pathway, the pathway, the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system that we are so familiar with when managing hypertension, whether in the form of ACE inhibitor or angiotensin receptor blocker. But it's kind of funny that we've largely ignored this pathway when it comes to hypotension. And I'd say ignored, but we had their case reports dating back to the 1930s of utilizing angiotensin II for those with hypotension. And a number of case series and case reports over the ensuing decades have addressed its use in women who, even pre-hypotension, in the setting of spinal anesthesia, received it. We've given it globally, largely in Europe over decades ago, in individuals with septic shock and had good responses. And at least, granted, there's a publication bias at hand, but there really have not been any documented safety issues with it beyond what we classically experience with catecholamines. As we've seen in this trial, which we'll get to in a bit, there is a trend towards even fewer safety problems with it compared to our existing standard of care drugs for the management of refractory hypotension and septic shock.
Outstanding. So in terms of thinking about that, this sort of untapped pathway that we really haven't focused on. With that background, Mike, start to tell us specifically what this study evaluated.
So this study evaluated individuals with septic shock who had received vasopressors and high-dose vasopressors at that, which means over 0.2 mics per kg per minute for at least 6 hours and up to 48 hours. And we took those patients, and after all the proper consent and et cetera and screening that was done, if these patients were enrolled in the trial, they received either placebo or the study drug. And we, the investigators, were blinded to the therapy for those patients. The patients themselves that were enrolled had a very strict protocol that was followed that entailed basically maintaining a goal mean arterial pressure, not changing the baseline vasopressors that got them to the enrollment mean arterial pressure goal. And we titrated either study drug or placebo, again, unknown to me, every 5 to 15 minutes, depending on the mean arterial pressure at hand.
So let me just ask just a few follow-up questions to that, just so everybody listening to the podcast. These patients came in, identified sepsis as we normally would with usual definitions. They received fluid resuscitation. They did not reach goal MAP with fluids, so they were started on vasopressors. And then when you say the 0.2 micrograms per kg per minute, is that norepinephrine that you were using primarily for these patients?
It was, yeah. So pretty much everyone was on norepinephrine, but we used norepinephrine equivalent dose. And how do you calculate that? Clearly, norepinephrine, it's straightforward. But for vasopressin, which according to our typical use of it, which is 0.04 units per minute, that is the equivalent of 0.1 norepinephrine equivalents.
Okay.
So we would sum that if it exceeded the 0.2 threshold and were on that for at least 6 hours, that's when they would meet that catecholamine-resistant hypotension definition.
Okay, great. And these patients, were they getting central lines? Did they have arterial lines in them as part of the protocol?
Yeah, they did. They had all of the above.
Okay, so just so everybody's clear, that's the patient we're talking about in terms of using this. Okay, go ahead.
And just a side note, so I was involved in the process trial as well, and a big challenge with the process trial is that we had to enroll these patients within 3 hours of identification of septic shock in the emergency department, mm-hmm. which, as you and all the listeners know, is a real challenge. But the attractiveness from my standpoint of this study is that we had 6 hours from the initiation of the pressors to enroll these patients.
Okay.
And these patients, I affectionately refer to the trial as the Ellis Island trial because it's give me your poor, your tired, you know, your huddled masses, because it was anyone who wouldn't qualify for most trials would qualify for this because they really represented the sort of septic shock train wrecks that we so commonly deal with.
Okay.
That may be excluded for other reasons in other trials.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's go through. Tell us how many people you included and then a few other statistics. What were their baseline characteristics? And really, let's then drive home. What were the results?
There were 75 ICUs from 9 countries. There's 321 patients were randomized in a 1-to-1 fashion according to their baseline MAP.
So those are the numbers.
Those are the numbers.
All right. So what's the big drum roll here, results?
Okay, so before we get to the results, the primary outcome, so it was a phase 3 trial that was approved by the FDA ahead of time. So the primary outcome wasn't mortality up front, which, you know, some criticize, but I would argue is a very relevant primary outcome, is mean arterial pressure at 3 hours.
Okay.
As it stands, to give you a little background, there aren't any studies that were geared to demonstrate improved mortality outcome in patients receiving norepinephrine or other vasopressors because it's just common sense, right? You need blood pressure to live. And so gearing a trial for pure mortality, which is in such a heterogeneous type of population in our ICUs, particularly those with shock, I don't know how relevant that is. So the primary outcome is mean arterial pressure at 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And to address the drum roll, it's roughly 70% of those that received the study drug, the angiotensin II, reached that primary outcome, which was an increase in their map by at least 10 meters of mercury, or in reaching their goal mean arterial pressure of 75.
So that's pretty significant in terms of the number of patients who responded to angiotensin II.
Right, so 70% responded. Those in the placebo group, you know, 23%, quote, responded. You know, is statistically significant p-value out to like the 14th decimal place, demonstrating a difference in reaching that primary outcome. And the secondary outcomes were interesting as well. I mentioned there haven't been any pressor studies looking at mortality as a main outcome. I mean, the p-value at 28 days was down to 0.12. Clearly not statistically significant based on our common use and understanding of it in medicine, but the all curves were pretty impressive. There's great separation, the Kaplan-Meier curves, and is definitely an exciting result to have.
That's outstanding, Mike. Well, Osman, we haven't had you comment yet, so let's bring you in the conversation here. And I understand that you have some pearls with respect to the medication itself.
Yes, absolutely. So here at University of Maryland, we enrolled 11 patients. And just from the clinical bedside standpoint, it was a very easy to use drug for the nurses to administer. Overall, we did have one dedicated line for the drug, but it does have the ability to piggyback off the same pump as well. So from a clinical standpoint, I think that the nurses were very happy with administering the drug. We were at the bedside for the first 3 hours while the drug was being actively titrated. But as well, I think that we were blinded while we were going through the process of administering the drug. But afterwards, you could see that patients that did receive the drug were titrated off standard of care pressors, and some patients were just on the study drug for up to 7 days with standard of care pressors completely titrated off. And so definitely some positive results and easy clinical use, no sort of complications from the nursing standpoint and support staff.
Let me ask just a few follow-up questions there, because there's going to be many people listening to this who are just hearing this for the first time, haven't had a chance to delve into the article, and many also listening who have read the article and are starting to digest it and how to potentially use it in clinical practice. I think probably most of us, myself included, actually, what is the dosing for angiotensin II?
So 20 nanograms per kilogram per minute, and just based off of certain maps, we at 15-minute intervals, we adjusted the drug to reach a goal map of greater than or equal to 65 millimeters of mercury.
Okay, outstanding. And you may not know this, but I'm sure many of us would be cost conscious. Do we know the cost of angiotensin II?
They're still working on it, so we do not quite know the cost. But one interesting thing, and I'll kind of leave it to Osman to address, you know, how we could at the bedside assess when those patients that were, quote, responders received the medication, the mean arterial pressure. I mean, I haven't seen anything like it. Within less than a minute, we'd have somebody with high dose baseline vasopressin and high dose norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. We're struggling to keep a MAP of 65 and receive within less than a minute of receiving something, whether placebo, yeah, and it's my, you know, magical thinking, or the study drug itself. I mean, you see the MAP shoot to 90 within less than a minute. I mean, I haven't seen anything like that, other than like putting a chest tube in somebody with a tension pneumo, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
Pretty impressive. Well, now, Mike, I know that you've recently come back from additional discussions and meetings regarding this particular study, but as a whole, as being one of the primary investigators and you take a look at this study, what are some of the limitations, if any, that you found or with this specific study in general?
Yeah, so some of the limitations, I mean, many will argue, oh, what's the mortality? What's the cost? What are the cost savings in terms of length of stay in the ICU? And those things are being looked at, so it's tough to really say, and it wasn't really addressed in this trial. But in terms of limitations, things that I typically think of, is it an effective drug and a drug that I would ideally, all things being equal, that I would want to use in my toolbox? Mm-hmm. And I mean, it reached its primary endpoint easily and secondary endpoints, which were meaningful, although it wasn't powered to address those. I mean, certainly hypothesis generating and results, but very encouraging. Number two, is it risky? What's the safety profile of the medication? And interestingly, in this large trial, there were actually fewer adverse events in the group that received the study drug compared to those that received placebo. And we had more dropouts from the study in those, which were only a handful, but more dropouts in the study from adverse events in the placebo group. Mm-hmm. And just online, it hasn't been released in print yet. In the Journal of Care Medicine, they did a multi-thousand patient analysis of the safety profile of the drug. And again, it's very encouraging. And the third thing, cost. And again, we don't know what that is, but I think, you know, a number of the health economics aspects will need to be addressed down the line to really determine, is this a drug that is a game changer in terms of shortening length of stay, improving outcomes, you know, decreasing overall time on pressors and exposure to those potentially harmful medications, although necessary many times. So we'll learn more about that over the ensuing months to years. But I think from a clinical applications and limitations and where do we go from here, I think this is one of the most encouraging studies I've seen in a while in this field of managing septic shock. So one more thing, Mike. About a year ago, for our Critical Care Fellows educational series, we brought in Mink Chawla, who's the professor of nephrology and critical care at George Washington University. He's now the CMO of the company, and he's in the area, and I brought him in to give a talk on angiotensin II and its use in septic shock. Guy's a very dynamic speaker and knowledgeable, clearly, in the area, as the whole idea of using it in this fashion was basically his brainchild. But he talked on it for our fellows, and we posted it online on our maryland.ccproject.com. His name is Mink Lakhmir Chawla, and he's one of the authors as well on this trial, and a great listen.
Well, thanks for that. Definitely head on over to the Maryland CC Project and take a listen to that lecture. Very, very informative and provides great background along with some lead into for this particular study. Well, a big, big congrats to you for being involved and included in the authorship, certainly participation for New England Journal of Medicine study. Many, many, many go their whole career without having a primary original research article in New England Journal. So a big congrats to you for all of your efforts in doing that and having the study published and really with some impressive results. It's something that a lot of folks, as I said, alluded to. Many, many are talking about this, you know, across the world in terms of how do we incorporate it or think about this in the practice of managing our patients with refractory septic shock despite our conventional vasopressor. So well done. And thanks so much here for joining us on the podcast, bringing us up to date on the latest groundbreaking, hot off the press literature in critical care and emergency medicine. So thanks so much for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us, Mike.
All right. If any of you have follow-up questions for Osman or Mike regarding the angiotensin II study, please shoot us an email through the website. I'll forward that on to Mike for his thoughts and replies. But our thanks to both of them once again for joining us here on the podcast, and we will talk to you next month.